At this time, we'll call the work session to order. We'll do roll call on the fly as normal. And tonight, our discussion is about UDC amendments. And Dan Olson is going to be working with John Sutter to present with us tonight. So welcome, you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah.
John's bringing up the PowerPoint.
Pretty hot.
Okay. So as you mentioned, we just wanted to have a discussion with you about some miscellaneous amendments to the UDC that we're proposing. So the purpose of these amendments is to just clarify existing provisions or practices, correct typographical errors, and then also make adjustments to development standards to address things that we learned as we administered the UDC. It's, as you, for those who've been on the council for a while, this is kind of a routine thing in a lot of ways. We do this every year where we just make all these tweaks. I keep a running list of things as I, throughout the year, that I see or would want to change. So this is what we're doing tonight. The proposed timeline, we're on the second meeting, which the first one was to have a very similar meeting with the Planning Commission. And I'll talk about their comments in a minute, but after tonight, it would go for public hearing on October 9th. Then it would come back to you on October 17th for the first reading, second reading November 7th. And then we publish it November 16th, and that goes into effect on the 16th of December. So that's kind of the proposed timeline if it all goes well. At the August 14 Plan Commission, they made some suggested changes. They were pretty minor tweaks, and those have been incorporated into the attachment A that you have before you. Since the August 14 Plan Commission, we've had even added more to what we had just for them, and we'll obviously make them aware of these as well when we go back to them. But I just wanted to focus tonight on the five additional. Actually, it's six additional because there's two rezonings as well. but these are the additional language that we've requested to be amended after the Planning Commission work session. I'll go through these. I have a slide for each. So the first is dealing with what's called sacred communities or micro unit dwellings. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but this year, the state legislature adopted a statute that goes into effect January 1st, and it mandates that all cities in Minnesota allow in their zoning codes for religious institutions to create what's called micro unit dwellings for the chronically homeless and extremely low income persons. And those are defined, of course, in state statute. So the legislation allows cities to make these either a permitted use, which is without city council review and approval, or we can require that a conditional use permit be issued before it is allowed. The only difference with a CUP in this case is the legislature also said that if you're going to be doing it by CUP, you can't have any conditions to the CUP. So right. That is, we're working with the statute that they gave us, and that's how I incorporated it into the UDC. So what I proposed here is that it be allowed in the same districts that religious institutions are allowed, which is R1, R2, R3, commercial, and industrial. So those five districts. First, I started off with a definition of micro unit dwelling, and there it is in the screen. It's just kind of what I described. It's really referring to the state statute for the details of these terms that they're using, chronically homeless and extremely low income. Designated volunteers are people who are not chronically homeless or extremely low income, but they have volunteered to live in the what they call a sacred community. That's what this group of dwellings is going to be called. They live there voluntarily, And I believe that the statute says that there has to be a certain percentage of all the units, a certain percentage of them have to be occupied by these called by these so-called designated volunteers. So so they on the bottom there is where I've shown in the table where they this would be it'd be conditional uses in those five districts. They don't. Okay, so that's, then we would also have what are called use-specific standards. We have these for a lot of the uses in the zoning code. And there's five of them, and I really base these on what is in the statute. The first is that each unit shall not exceed gross floor area of 400 square feet. The second is that the dwelling shall be constructed to be compatible with the religious institution. The principal building of the institution, I should say. The third is the residents of each dwelling unit should have access to water and electric utilities. And they can do that by either having it in the dwelling unit itself or just having it having access to it in the principal structure of the religious institution. Fourth is that this is from state statute, of course. The application for a CUP shall contain a written plan which addresses several different elements in the statute. And fifth is for any city-approved micro-dwelling unit, the religious institution shall annually certify to the city that it has complied with the eligibility requirements for residents. And this is just certifying that people are different of the required income levels or just that type of thing. They have met those. So I put that in as a use specific standard. And then lastly, this, it talks about having a setback for these from the property line. So it suggests 10 feet. So that's what I've used.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to add something in case you're wondering if the state has set the rules and the city can't set additional rules. Why are we making this a conditional use instead of just a permitted use? Why are we making them go through the process of having a planning commission public hearing, notifying all the neighbors, and then have the city council vote on it? The reason to do that is to let the public know, in case there are objections, where to direct their ire, frankly, is to the legislature, not to the city. If we just did it as a permitted use and they do this and the neighbors get upset about it, why weren't we notified, right? Why didn't anyone tell us about this? At least if you have this public process that gives you, the elected officials, in addition to staff, the opportunity to explain to our residents that, well, these are the rules the state set and all we can do is implement them. They didn't give us any latitude. So that, again, if you're wondering, well, why not just make it a permitted use? That is the reason to do a CUP. It also does make it a little easier to do enforcement if they don't follow the rules in the state statute. But to us, I think when we talked about it internally, the primary purpose is to make sure that there is a public process. So at least the public knows what's coming, knows why it's happening, and if the city is doing all it can in terms of this particular use.
I would also add too, I'm sorry, I didn't make that obvious, I didn't bring that up, but I think also the applicant is aware then in writing what the city expects and based on the statute. So they have it, it's not just something they've been told verbally, but they also see in the staff report that this is what is expected. And they have some work to do. For example, they have to draw up this written plan. So that's work for them to do, and they have to give thought to that about how they're going to manage this sacred community.
Go ahead, John.
With these micro units, I mean, is it possible that they would be like high rises of any kind? I mean, I see you have here like a maximum of 400 square feet per floor. Are you talking also that they could stack them?
Well, I would say it's probably going to be regulated by the regulations that we have for religious institutions. I don't think that if they're in the R1, I think the maximum is 32 feet. So they have to adhere to the same regulations that a religious institution would have in that particular zoning district.
Would that be three stories then, right? Roughly?
Roughly, yeah.
Well, it's in the R1, it's the two stories, I think.
Okay, two-story max.
But 30 feet would be three.
Yeah. And I think these have to meet either the building code or the, I mean, it's not like this is the only, these are the only zoning rules we can have. But I mean, there are like physical construction limitations on, you know, stacking these or whatever. So, I mean, whether it's in the building codes or somewhere else. So I wouldn't be concerned about that. I think our argument is that each these are supposed to be micro units, like separate buildings. I think that's clear in the intent of the statute. So we would say 400 square feet for like the footprint of a little one-story box. Anything more than that is probably not going to meet the building code or other codes. And also, I think we could argue that it's not what the legislature intended when they passed this, that there was a very specific type of structure that they were picturing, which is basically the little semi-portable small dwellings that you could move around to different sites as needed.
You're saying mobile.
So these are all supposed to be mobile? Mm-hmm.
They can be.
They don't have to be.
But they probably would be.
Yeah, I did speak with our building official as well, just to go through some of these building code requirements. And he said that they are very standard and there was nothing really unusual about them. So.
Okay. Are these basically tiny homes? Because that's what my thought was that they are.
Yes, except the big difference is the portability. Mm. In fact, they don't have to have bathrooms within the units. They can have a communal bathroom, say, in the church itself. So the state made a point to have a very light touch in terms of regulation. And that, I guess that's another reason to do the CUP, is so that each proposal might be a little different in terms of how they provide, you know, sanitary facilities, how they provide eating facilities and cooking facilities. Is it in the church's kitchen or is it in some other structure? We don't know a lot going into this. So the CUP gives us the ability to evaluate each proposal based on its facts.
Yeah, go ahead, Forrest.
So I should have read the actual statute here, but is it possible that essentially, you could have tiny homes in a church parking lot,
as long as it doesn't reduce the parking below the minimum required for the size of the sanctuary under our zoning ordinance under the UDC.
But so okay,
I did look at. I think we have six religious institutions in Crystal, and of the five of the six are zoned R1. Only one is zoned commercial, so. Most likely, if we do have these, are going to be following regulations that are in the R1, in addition to.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
So what I'm thinking of is like in case of a tornado, right? Are these units anchored or are they going to be able to, you know, get shelter someplace, be able to. I just can't imagine if there's any kind of like high wind or a tornadic activity, you know, that these things are going to be safe, and if they do get off the ground, you know, the destruction that goes with it. So, I mean, is that included in this as well?
I have to check this to see if there's what to say that. It says here, be built on a permanent chassis and anchored to pin foundation with engineered fasteners.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if that would be durable during a tornado or not.
That sounds like a mobile home. So most mobile home facilities have to have some type of better structure or shelter from a tornado than that. So again, we're kind of going into this. This is a big unknown.
Okay.
And the legislature, of course, didn't consider all the angles. And we would, you know, we would evaluate that during the CUP process.
Okay. Tracy.
Is anyone going to do inspections of these to make sure that everything's up to code and that all these requirements are met?
We would do that.
So it falls on the cities?
It would be through building inspections. We wouldn't, I don't foresee us doing a rental licensing for this.
Yeah. No.
Once it's built and tenants are in, is there any sort of inspection
I would say it'd be a more complaint basis after that. If we, okay. if somebody complains or we see something that's blatantly not what was approved, then we could address it. But
so then those complaints go to the city and not the state.
Potentially they could, I would think the city would probably deal with them. Okay. Unless it's something that we would involve. I don't know why, I can't think of an example where we would involve the state, but.
I didn't know if because it was all kind of under state code but or whatever.
I think the question you're getting to is like, okay, who is going to be responsible for regulating these?
Right.
There's no state agency in the statute or, I mean, anyone at the state who's really responsible for that. It's all on whatever the local jurisdiction is, to whatever extent regulation is even allowed. So it would be us.
So if you had to shut one down because of violations or, you know, things aren't at code, is that going to fall on the city staff to have to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Worst.
So under the CUP process, is it kind of a CUP for, like, could the city council deny it?
Well, you might have some legal exposure.
Okay.
To do that. I'm guessing this law will be tested. Some yeah. city will deny one at some point, and they will probably appeal. They will take it to district court and see where it goes. That would be my guess.
Okay.
I can't predict what we would recommend to you until we see an actual proposal. Mm-hmm. We may never get a proposal. We have no way of knowing, but if we get one, we would evaluate the specific details and make a recommendation to you. The city attorney might make a recommendation if there's some question about whether it should be approved, as to whether the city would be taking risk and not approving it. I just don't have those answers at this time.
Is there any risk to having this be a conditional use at all? Because is it possible that, you know, they would just say, well, this, we don't believe this is even something that we need to do it anyways, because it should just be permitted under, is there something in the statute that says
yes.
cities must XYZ?
There is a provision in the statute that says cities can either make these permitted uses or conditional.
Oh, okay. So there is, okay. Yeah, that, thank you.
But it does say, again, if you make it a conditional use, there's no conditions.
Okay.
So it's an up.
It's permitted. It's a permitted use.
That was a good one.
In most ways, except for what John alluded to earlier with the whole public notification process, which I think there's value in that. So.
Okay.
And enforcement, if there are issues, if there are violations of the statute, CUP gives us an enforcement tool that we wouldn't have if we're just it's a permitted use, but we didn't have to issue any approval. Now, what would we be rolling back if they violate the terms of the statute?
And then I just have one quick question. So the setbacks here, you said they were recommended. Is that recommended with like a big R or?
Well, maybe I shouldn't worry about recommended.
Okay.
I'll read the exact language. It says micro units must comply with municipal setback requirements established by ordinance for manufactured homes. We don't have anything specifically for manufactured homes. And then it goes on to say, if a municipality does not have such an ordinance, micro units must be set back on all sides by at least 10 feet.
So why don't we, because this seems like less than some of our setbacks for other structures, if I'm not, I mean, is this, how far off is this from setbacks and other, for normal structures in like R1, R2?
Well, a single family home will be 30, it'll have a setback along the front property line of 30 feet. So this would be 10 feet.
Well, why don't we just do what everybody else has to do?
What about a garage?
A detached garage is typically 5 feet.
5 feet, see. So
from the side or the rear,
not the front.
Front.
We also, it's 30 from the front as well for their garage,
yeah.
Detached garage.
Yeah.
I'm taking the advice of the League of Most of the Cities, which really worked heavily on this with the state legislators, is that we can't add to this. So that's why I set the setback at 10 feet, because that's what it says we have to.
But doesn't it say at least there?
It says must be set back on all sides by at least 10 feet. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty clear that we can go higher. I mean,
yeah, I guess that's true. We could make it greater.
I would like to see it match what it normally is for structures. And
We could do what we do for pretty much every thing in the R1. We could say it can't be closer to the street than the principal building.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would cover us a lot. At least it would be on the side or behind a building.
Yeah.
I would recommend a slightly different approach. We hadn't really talked about this, so we're kind of doing this on the fly, but that's why we have these discussions. As I would just say, 30 feet front and or 30 feet from any, probably 30 feet from the from any lot line abutting a street, whether it's so if it's a corner lot, it's not exactly the same as R1, but these are institutional uses. This mm-hmm. is not a house, right? So there's a logic to kind of have our own setback. So how about 30 feet from any lot line abutting a public street, and then 10 feet from any other lot line, whether it's a side or interior side or rear lot line. That way, if it's on a corner, it's 30 from each lot line along the street.
Yeah, it makes sense to me that it would be 30 feet, and using both on a corner, that's fine. Unfortunately, we can't use 5. Because of the way it's written, it has to be at least 10. So we're already not going to be matching what a residential zoning would be. So make it what we want. I think that's fair.
John, Dan, we haven't done any type of analysis as to any of the eligible religious institutions that this would By adjusting the setbacks at 30, it would prohibit or preclude the placement of them. Have we? Or,
we have not done that analysis. No, okay. I could.
Oh, it might.
Well,
I'm thinking of one over here.
I don't know what the impact of that would be.
The
San Rafael,
the campus, or
yeah,
the Cambodian one.
Oh, Cambodian.
That parking lot's pretty big and deep. I would say
definitely long.
Yeah, I pass it like every day. So I'd say that one it wouldn't preclude it.
Okay.
Depending on the minimum, I mean I don't know what the minimum parking spots is, but that's a huge parking lot for.
With the 30 feet from any street, any lot line along a street, that I mean I can't picture a religious institution in the city that wouldn't have space for something. They might not be able to make it as big of a sacred community as a church with more land, but that's normal. I mean, even churches that have like St. James has streets on three sides of their facility, but it's only 30 feet from those lot lines. So there's still a large area on that property where they could do that. So the Cambodian Church of the Nazarene, that they clearly have room 30 feet south of 45th Avenue. So I can't picture any of our religious institutions that wouldn't be able to accommodate something like this.
Yeah.
I just don't know how many units.
I forget the name of the Lutheran church right up here.
St. James.
Yeah, that one. I mean, it would have to be probably in the auxiliary parking lot there.
Which they don't use. We've had discussions with them about that recently where they don't use that parking lot at all. So.
Oh.
Interesting. Is there an option for a variance? I mean, could they apply for a variance on that?
To the setback?
Yeah, on the setback piece.
Probably not the 10-foot, because that's in the statute, but the 30-foot? Yes, it's in the UDC, so it certainly is something that you could consider a variance on.
Okay. I think that's an obvious tool if there's something that really prohibits it for someone.
Yep. I do see in this plan that they'll be submitting it. It does talk about that one of the things that they have to address is safety protocols for severe weather.
So they'll
have to give that some thought anyway.
Okay. All right. That's it.
Okay. Okay. So the next thing is nursery or preschools in the town center. So this is the base district, DC. We realized that there are two existing nursery schools in TC. So we didn't, right now they're not permitted at all. The reason being for that was because we were trying to develop uses that we thought were pedestrian, created a lot of pedestrian traffic, so to speak. And that one didn't really make the cut, but just kind of reconsidering that, we think it seems okay that they could create traffic just as much as anything else. So we're proposing that it be a conditional use, which is the same use that it would be in the TCPD, be a conditional use. And then along with that, we would also allow we regulate the fencing of an outdoor play area. We would allow it for that particular use, because we don't allow fences in the TC base district, but we would allow it for that particular use, although you could not have chain link fence. Mm. So that's what we're proposing for preschools in the TC.
I think I can tell them about the application. It's not at the TC, it's in the TCPD, but just as an FYI, today we received a conditional use permit application for New Horizon to significantly remodel the office building at 7057th Avenue North, which is just kind of west of the Aldi and north of the
immediately south of U-Haul,
the former Thriftway building, and north of the current Wells Fargo building property. Mm. So there's a little off. There are two office buildings there. This is the one that's east of Kentucky and north of 57. And they'll be doing a substantial complete renovation of the building and the site. This is a fairly significant investment. So since we got the application, we've been working with them for a while. Dan mostly has been working with them, but you should know, since the application was submitted today, that it's technically public. So just be aware of that in our TC area, which is sort of related to this amendment, although not directly.
That would fall in the TCPD, but they're not proposing to rezone it to TCPD. They're just going to keep it at commercial, which is the base district, I guess you call it, but which is there. They have that option. So.
Very good.
Next thing is one family attached dwellings, i.e. townhomes in the TC district. Again, this is the base district. In an effort to really create tight density in the TC district, which is the area surrounding Becker Park, I wrote the TC district regulations to not allow townhomes, but we have met with several developers over the last couple of years, and some of them wanted to have townhomes as part of an apartment building, not standalone townhomes.
Kind of like what's in Golden Valley on Winnetka and Medicine Lake?
I'm not sure if I'm familiar with that.
Where it's like townhomes and then an apartment building kind of behind it? Oh.
No, I think the mayor has seen it in Dallas.
Yeah.
The what were supposed to be retail spaces opening right onto the light rail station platform, and they couldn't rent them as retail. So they ended up turning into basically apartments with their own separate entrances. So that, and we've had, is it one or two developers who've proposed, they never were able to make it work, but their concept was for the ground floor, that there would be townhome style units built into the apartment building. You have this big apartment building, and all the upper floors had like an apartment where you have a common entrance and you go up in elevators. But then there'd be this bank of townhome style units on one or two fronts of the building that would open directly onto the public sidewalk, just like a townhome. So that's what we're trying to allow.
And those opened up right next to the tracks in Dallas. That was something else. Right, John.
We have that on Washington Avenue in the North Loop, where they have like those type of I don't know if they're called townhomes, but they actually have their own separate entrances, you know, to the sidewalk. So you don't have to go through the elevator system to get to them. You can actually kind of walk out, and they'll have like a little patio separate from the sidewalk itself. I mean, it seems kind of like, you know, it's not very private, but you know, they are like that on Washington Avenue there.
So I see them all over town. And there's some by the river as well, by the old Gold Medal building. Yeah.
I think there's some in Brooklyn Park on Zane, just south of Brooklyn Boulevard. If people have been through over there, there's like row houses, kind of townhomes connected there.
Yeah.
Like on the west side of Zane.
Yeah. I think they tried to do like mixed retail or something like that, and it didn't work. And then they converted them. So Makes sense.
Yeah, it was something we really never had thought of until we start meeting with developers. And they're like, well, hey, what do you think about this? And we thought that was a great idea, but we just couldn't allow it in our, with according to the way it was written. But this would change that. So, but
I thought we talked about that when we set that up, didn't we? About having that main floor being something that was allowed to be convertible either way, depending on demand. Did we not?
We did talk about it, but I don't think we talked about it in the context of the TC ordinance.
Okay.
Which was a couple of these were things that were in this model code that we got handed down to us, and then we tried to fix it, and we missed a couple of things. This is one of those things that we missed.
Yeah. Like it.
So this relates motor vehicle and RV licensing. City code section 1325 allows motor and recreational vehicles to be parked or stored outdoors as long as they are currently licensed as required by law. It was recently learned that there is nothing in state law that requires them to be currently licensed. So therefore we are proposing that in the parking or section, the off-street parking section of the UDC, that we require that motor vehicles and motor vehicles and RVs that are parked or stored outside on private property, that they be currently licensed and that registration be clearly visible.
So this is what, trying to fix something that's sitting there year after year after year, not being moved, not being kept up. Is that kind of what we're getting at on this one? What are we trying to fix here?
That is exactly it. And while residential property is probably what comes to mind, someone's got a vehicle parked in the driveway and they haven't renewed their tabs. Usually if that's the case, there's something else with the vehicle that's wrong, or there's some other issues with the property. But the big concern I think that we have is commercial parking lots. Right now, if there is a vehicle that's sitting there indefinitely, basically abandoned in a commercial parking lot, but the only thing wrong with it is that tabs aren't current. We used to enforce this. And then the police department recently pointed out that the statute doesn't actually say what the city for years had thought it said. So, but as we thought about that, then it was, you know, what about these commercial parking lots, right? Where you could have vehicles just kind of accumulating. I mean, you'd think the owner would care, but we don't want to rely on the owner to care, especially with some of our commercial properties. So I think it's not just residential. It's also commercial industrial parking lots where we might have basically vehicle clutter. In terms of on residential property, this is not something that we would seek out. But if there are other issues at the property, it's another tool in the toolbox, as the cliche goes.
Yeah, go ahead, Forrest.
I mean, as somebody who has a family member that has a project car, I don't feel entirely comfortable having it be like, you know, any car, you know, boom, drive by, give you a ticket because you didn't have, you know, you had a vehicle that wasn't licensed. I mean, nobody likes being neighbors with somebody that has multiple junk cars and just they're just in the driveway leaking and they look like garbage. But I don't know how I feel about this one.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
I was just curious about boats, because I can think of a few people around town that have boats in their yard forever, and I don't know if they ever use them. I don't know if there's a thing in the code similar to this or if that's even feasible.
It says the language is recreational vehicles and equipment. And I looked up in 1325, what does equipment mean? And it does cover boats.
Okay. So, interesting. Okay.
So one, based on the concerns I'm hearing, one option would be to only require this of non-residential property or we'd have to figure that out. If your concern is residents with a project car, again, it still needs to be operable. you know, it can't have missing wheels and stuff and be sitting outside. Mm-hmm. They should move it in their garage if it's that bad. But, mm-hmm. you know, if it's otherwise operable or looks operable, the tires are aired up, it's not busted up, and they just aren't doing the tabs because they're not driving it right now, then, okay, maybe we should exempt residential property from this. But I think it's very important to keep it for non-residential property, because that our commercial properties are what people complain about mostly in terms of the way our city looks, and having cars sitting there indefinitely and not being able to do anything about it, I think is not something we want to have.
Are there any other tools in the toolbox for residential properties that have, you know, it's not just the one car and everything else as well manicured or something, or is this really the only tool that the city has for enforcing junk cars on a property?
We have something else for about inoperable vehicles, correct?
Well, the only thing I'm aware about is relating to vehicle repair shops.
In 1330, though.
Oh, in 13.
I'm pretty sure that this is just specific to current invisible license plate tabs. So we can either confirm that elsewhere in the code, there's already a prohibition about inoperable vehicles being parked or stored outside. And if that's the case, then there's our tool for those. If it's not in the code, we could look at amending 1330, or we could add it to the UDC depending on what's most appropriate. But I'm pretty sure 1330 has something about inoperable vehicles. Well, and you can see 1325 talks about, that's where this all came up in the motor vehicle section of the code. The issue was the police were trying to enforce the thing about tabs, and they saw, actually, the statute doesn't say people can't do that on their property. So, but there are other provisions in this same part of the code in 1330 or 1325, wherever, that pertain to inoperable vehicles. So we will confirm that.
Yeah. I feel like this wouldn't even be the best tool for somebody that does have like a bunch, like it's like, okay, well, I'll just license a couple of them or whatever. I don't know.
So first thing that came to mind when I read this was for the commercial property. And it didn't even occur to me that there might be vehicles parked that were abandoned. It didn't even occur to me. What occurred to me was that the commercial owner is renting space out for people to store. And that would, in essence, prevent that if it wasn't licensed. That's going to be an effect of what you're proposing.
Correct. Yes.
And
well, sorry, if it's not licensed, I mean, that's
correct. The key. Yeah. Correct. That is the key. If it were inside of a fenced area, would that be a completely different story? It would not.
No.
So now we're restricting the use of that space for those particular commercial residents.
Well, I think the rationale, I think the rationale is that commercial parking lots are supposed to be for people using the commercial property, the store, whatever, the factory, whatever it is. They're not supposed to be just certain vehicle parking as a principal use anyway. And so if they, the concern is everyone's trying to find places throughout the metro to put the cars that they can't do something with right now. They basically need a boneyard. And the problem is Crystal has a lot of cheap land. So they wouldn't be able to afford to do this in, you know, a wealthier inner ring suburb. So the question, I guess, for the council is, do you want Crystal to be the place that attracts that kind of vehicle storage? Because that's what will probably happen just given market forces. So that's why we're concerned about commercial and industrial properties much more than residential. Residential properties are generally more self-regulating because people have neighbors. They live here, they, you know, and not every neighbor is great, but most people want to get along with their neighbors. Most of our commercial property owners are absentee. They have no connection to Crystal other than it's where their property is. So that's, I think, why staff's greater focus is on the commercial parking lots. And yeah, I mean, let's say Target or Crystal Shopping Center, they shouldn't be using that parking lot to rent out, just let people store stuff there. That's not why we allow those parking lots. They're there to serve the businesses that are there. And if they have so much surplus parking that they want to rent it out, then they ought to redevelop some of those parking lots for something better for the community. And that's just my opinion, but that's kind of where we're coming from.
All right. Oh, go ahead, John.
I guess that's a good point because I see vehicles that are like behind Planet Fitness or whatever, behind Marshall's. That's where those, you know, so-called, you know, junker vehicles are. I don't know if they're associated with the building at all, or if they're just, you know, people just put them back there because they don't have a place to park them at the apartment buildings or at the houses back there. And it's just kind of an easy, convenient place until winter comes where they actually have to move them. So,
well, and remember, this is only if they're not currently licensed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is only for vehicles that actually are not street legal because they don't have current registration that's visible. So if they keep it licensed, at least somebody cares about that car. You know what I mean? It's not just sitting there for a year, right? Mm-hmm. Presumably. So short-term use, like you might have a parking lot, apartment parking lot. We want to give people flexibility. So you might have an apartment parking lot where they need to plow it and they tell all their residents to get out for 24 hours. And the resident's like, where do I park my car? Well, they go park it in a commercial parking lot. Okay. You know, it's not, this isn't going to affect that. But it is going to affect, it will be more likely to affect vehicles that are basically being dumped at a commercial parking lot in Crystal and just sitting there, not actually using it. And that's kind of the target audience, I guess.
Well,
yeah, for me, it's just very difficult because I think that this type of regulation, you could end up having like a lot of, you know, it could affect a lot of people that you're not intending to affect. I mean, your use case that the problem you described is very compelling, but I think that you could see yourself, you know, with a bad actor in a way, somebody using this in a bad or in a way that was more like driving down parking lots, trying to get every single person at the Target parking lot who didn't renew that month. Right. versus, you know, actually trying to attack the problem, which is in your mind, in the problem you've described, somebody coming here, buying a vacant lot and then just stashing a bunch of cars there. I mean, Is this really the only tool to prevent that, or is there a more surgical tool to prevent junky properties than this?
Well, it's a question of what you can prove, right? It's easy to see if a vehicle is currently registered. We have to then somehow prove that a vehicle sat there for a certain length of time, it becomes a much more challenging and time-consuming process. I hadn't even thought about the actual customer parking, the parking lot. I can't speak for the police department. I don't know if they've ever done that in the past. I would doubt that they do that now, even if they did do it in the past. But I think that's a question that we should ask the police department about, to see if, as a matter of policy, they even do that. I know as council members, it's tough to, when staff tells you trust us to be reasonable, because even if you trust us, you don't know who's
going to be there
in 20 years. Right? 10 years or whatever. And B, when you're writing laws, it's discomforting to just trust people. You want the law to get the law right. So I totally understand that. On the practical side of things, though, what I'm hearing here is we should talk with the police department more specifically about whether they even do what you describe anymore. I think they used to, like 10 years ago, maybe, whether they would even do that, and whether and how they would provide whatever assurance you might be looking for that they wouldn't use this tool in that way. Because that's not what we're intending, but I can't speak.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how we write it, how we present it. All of us could be gone, and you know, whether it be council or police chiefs or whatever, we'll look at the law, read the law, and say, well, okay, well, that means we can do that, and they may. So, I think it needs to be clear whether that's, we need to clearly rule it out or clearly allow it, depending on what our desire is in that realm.
What's the penalty if, say, that there's a vehicle discovered that's not currently licensed? What is it, instantaneous? They towed the truck to impound, or is it a fine, or what?
That's a great question. We'll get more information from the police about what they do, but just anecdotally from what they have done is they give notice, usually multiple notices. Towing on private property, I don't think we can do that. I think the highest thing we can do would be a citation for a violation of the code, city code. But the I know even for, well, they give warnings and time to correct.
So that almost seems kind of like a built-in preventing something like Forrest is talking about. I mean, if we're giving notice and these notices are going unchecked, then it's not like it's just somebody who's storing it there for a short time. Or, so, you know what I mean?
That's fair, but you're both right. So, yeah. I mean, practically speaking, that's how we think the police would use it. But the way this is written, they could troll a parking lot at Target and immediately write a citation based on city code for that violation or not having current.
Could it be like a warning first? And then, I mean, I guess it would depend on what the police do, but it'd be nice if there was like a warning first.
Well, like we outline what.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
We have some more work to do on this. Give us an opportunity to sure. work on this. I think I'm not hearing any council members that don't have concerns about this. So I think we need to address the concerns that we have heard. And before we bring it to the planning commission.
And you'll let us know about the residential side too, if there's anything currently preventing like RVs that are sitting there that aren't licensed or that aren't current. I'm just curious if there's anything, rather than just saying, let's just make this commercial and ignore the residential. I think there should be some sort of something in the residential piece.
As far as being inoperable.
Yes.
Not maintained.
Right. Or like as number distinct. Of vehicles that are sitting there. Yeah.
Where it becomes like a nuisance.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I think that's an important distinction because this is kind of a status violation, mm-hmm. right, in and of itself versus a property or an RV that's busted up, busted taillights, tires are flat. I mean, that's what really sets people off when they don't like the way something looks. So, but we will confirm that we have something about operability being a requirement if it's parked outside.
Okay, thank you. Next.
This here relates to exterior materials for carports. The amendment would clarify that exterior material requirements apply not only to garages, detached garages, but also carports. So, the intent was always to have those two be subject to these exterior material requirements, but it was really an oversight that those two words were not included in that paragraph. So it's a cleanup thing is what it is.
Is there there's currently no requirements on carports?
Not for exterior materials.
I'm just curious. My neighbor has like one of those pop-up ones, and so it's not an eyesore. They've done it nicely, but obviously if we're going to do this, it's going to affect them. And I'm just a little sensitive about that.
Yeah. Well, in their case, they'd be grandfathered in.
Oh, they are. Okay. They so would. This is just new stuff.
This is for new.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
If that helps.
It does.
So we're just kind of looking for discussion. Should we talk about the two rezonings as well?
Yes. Let me change the share. These are in your staff report, but weren't in the actual slideshow. Which one do you want to do first, Dan?
3601. Douglas.
Okay, well, it's not. We're going to 3601. So let's.
We can do that one.
Okay, we'll do 3443.
Okay. 3443, which is that little sliver of land there, that's an EDA owned lot.
You share.
So 3443?
Yes, 3443.
Okay.
It's a vacant, it's vacant, of course, right now.
I'll bring up the aerial.
So it's currently zoned commercial, but staff is proposing to rezone it to R2, which is what it is guided as in the city's comprehensive plan. The rationale for rezoning is that the property has been vacant since 2010 when the home was demolished. It was rezoned in 2013 to commercial with the aim of redeveloping along with the office building that is now the suite living.
Yep.
Assisted a living facility just north of there.
There you go.
That didn't happen. They didn't want that to be part of, they were not interested in purchasing that property at the time. And so we don't really foresee a commercial use for this property in its future. And it is guided for R2 in the comp plan, as I said. So we would, that's the rationale for rezoning it to R2. It could be developed for a three-unit residential building under R2, or it could be, it could actually be townhomes too as well. We could do it as a PD, so we could have a little bit of density there. There is just south of there, you're probably aware that there's a townhome development that's been there since the mid-90s. So it's, it would fit in, I think, with this, the adjacent uses.
And also a eight-unit development, you just, townhome development, you just approved right here.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So it's kind of the theme of that area.
What's the building just north of it, the long building?
Is that that is the suite living.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah.
No. How wide is the property? Is it 50 feet?
It's actually, I think it's
63.
It's very, very narrow, but it's very deep. Very deep.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's too bad they didn't want it.
Yeah.
Like a Tupelo shotgun house of some kind.
Yeah.
The back of it is, it fronts on the Edgewood Avenue right-of-way, which is unimproved. So.
Mm.
I'll switch back to the 2021 aerial, which Hennepin County lets us show the streets. Oh, now it's not working. All right. Well, anyway, the Edgewood right-of-way runs north-south right through here. And there are some vacant lots here. We own one of them. There's more vacant lots here. So.
Hmm.
So do you have any questions about that rezoning?
No.
Okay.
John, you have a question?
So to have access to our other lots, would that, could that possibly be the access to those lots?
It could be. There's a lot of challenges to developing or to improving, I should say, Edgewood from 34th, which is just, that's the street that's running.
But do you need to? I mean, if you used 3443 as the access to those, you know, lots, would that, I mean.
Well, that would have, you mean that 3443 would actually be a street?
Yeah.
I think this challenge is, John Pike has a lot of sleep.
There's like a big hill back there too. I mean,
there is, yeah. There's a lot of elevation changes. There's also a lot of different owners on that Edgewood right of way. So some are, there's varying degrees of their interest of improving that street and having those lots developed. So there's issues there.
Which lot is ours?
The blue one here.
Oh, no.
The other one? Then we also have this one right here.
Okay.
So I think, I mean, that's a good point, a good question, but it isn't really something we have to decide now.
Sure.
To rezone it. But that's a very fair question, that instead of extending Edgewood north down the steep hill, which drops substantially right around these existing townhomes, it's really high here and really low down here. You could build a driveway or street here and try to pick up, I don't know how it would be done, if it would be a little townhome development or something. And maybe try to pick up this vacant lot here and then do something different on the high ground for these two vacant lots with a little stub of Edgewood maybe. The decision point on whether this should be built on or saved as a future, preserved as a future access route, that decision point would be at whatever point staff would come to you and say, hey, we want to talk about marketing this lot for a, say, a small residential multi, you know, like a small townhome building or multi-unit building. At that point, that is a very good reason not to do that. If you want to continue to hold it instead of try to sell it, would be until we know what's going on back here, we don't want to sell this.
I think that's a valid point. Because I mean, we've talked about these lots back here before and how the challenges of getting to them. And if that's the only way in or out to those lots, and we want to develop those lots back there or our lot back there, I think that would be the most viable way of connecting. So,
well, I mean, maybe not the most. I mean, obviously, if you do Edgewood, you take it through. We could take 3443 and divide it into two. You have one facing Douglas, one facing Edgewood.
That's true too.
You know,
we've talked about that as well.
Yeah. So, you know, which is better? I don't know. I think it goes back to willing partners. You know, we have a lot of these lots on Edgewood, 3455, 3449, 3443. Some of those are owned by the people who
sure.
have lots on Florida. And mm-hmm. then there's I know there's another person who's accumulated a couple of them. So,
but if you create an opportunity, right, for those to be developed,
right,
we develop our piece of property, I'm sure they're going to put homes on those other.
Yeah.
They're going to sell those lots.
Possibly, or some just may wait till they age out and it gets resold, you know. But yes, it becomes a viable build at some point in time. I think some of them like it for the privacy of it, and they have woods in their backyard, and they have some little bit of wildlife and nature in the backyard. That's kind of cool. That would be something that I would be interested in, but not in the form of a prairie. Excuse me, but. Yeah, there's options.
Are all those lots for sale?
No.
They're just, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a long-term play.
Yeah.
Just as an example, 3200 block of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
This is a development that went in about
2016?
6 years ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The developer, it was SVK Development, also known as Kevin Excavating. They very patiently, gradually bought up
10 lots, I think it was.
Yeah, well, they platted into 10 lots, but they bought up several larger parcels, including some that needed substantial soil correction in order to build on them. These four lots here between Hampshire and Georgia, there used to be a house, an old house that sat right in the middle of them. And they bought that and held it and rented it out for 10 years, maybe longer. I mean, it was a long-term play for a private developer. This development up here has a potential for 12 lots if this homeowner would eventually be willing to sell off the back 40% or so of their yard. They could then get two lots. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You can maybe get 12 single family lots in there, but there are six different owners. And they all, either you need a developer who's going to patiently accumulate those lots until they can do it, or they all need to sort of agree at the same time that they want to divest themselves of their land. So this is a very long-term prospect. So my favorite phrase, the short answer is, we'll have to make that decision if and when staff comes to you about, hey, let's talk about, do we want to try to sell 3443 Douglas, or do we want to continue to hold it? That we would have to talk about. I mean, that's the question, really. I mean, this lot has services. It's right, got access on Douglas. There's no question that it's a viable lot. today, but does that preclude then options for this little stuff in the future?
John?
Well, I think part of your answer is whether or not we want to be the ones that are driving the bus in terms of that development for that area. And typically, you know, we prefer, you know, to have people, you know, make proposals to us and then let us decide whether or not it's, you know, good fit for the city. So I would say, although I like the idea of having that as a, you know, through street to be able to get to our property back there, I would say let's just zone it R2, and because it's been sitting, I don't know how long we had it now?
2009.
So it's basically it's time for us to move on, I think. You know, nothing's going to change unless we do something.
But, and again, by rezoning, you're not committing to selling it.
True.
R2 works whether you hold it for 20 more years or whether next year you say, yeah, let's sell it.
And we could always come in and change as long as nothing's been built on it or sold, since it hasn't been sold. Like if we wanted to divide it and make it two separate lots. Yeah. We do hold the cards on that lot. I think that's a go ahead.
Okay. Then last, you gonna go?
I'll just go with the aerial.
Okay. 3601 Douglas. This is right across from spacing on the name of the new liquor store. That's
Wine Thief and Ale Jail.
Wine Thief, yes. Right across the street from Wine Thief. This is a property that's zoned commercial. It's the home of a two-family dwelling that was constructed in 1959. Staff is proposing to rezone it to R1. It is guided as R1, or low density in the city's comp plan. The property owner is in agreement with the rezoning. I've been unable to determine when it was zoned commercial, but presumably the property was zoned commercial. Said all four corners on that intersection would be zoned commercial to allow for redevelopment opportunities. That was kind of we believe that was the thinking. Given that the dwelling has been there almost 65 years, it's not likely that that will become a commercial development. So we are just proposing to rezone it to R1 just to, for that reason.
It meets the requirements for a duplex in R1, right? Except for there's one issue, but it would be non-grandfathered.
Right. That. Yeah. There was in the mid 80s, the county took some additional right of way there to create a turn lane. But it, as John said, it just makes it makes the dwelling legally non-conforming, so it can remain there and be rebuilt if it is burned down or something.
Okay. No questions.
I think the property owner didn't even realize it was zoned commercial.
Interesting.
Probably likely. Yeah.
Would you say it's too small of a parcel to really have any commercial prospects anyways?
I'm not so sure it's too small, but it's surrounded by single family residential, so it seems odd. Mm-hmm.
It is smaller than Wine Thief and Ale Jail. That's 0.4 acres. This is just under 0.3 acres. So it's even smaller than that. And that's
tight.
Wine Thief property is pretty tight anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think. It, not only has it not happened in decades that it's been zoned commercial, nobody has come to us and say, I saw that was zoned commercial. I want to tear that duplex down and build something else. but the market is certainly, I mean, duplexes are in high demand. They provide important naturally occurring affordable housing. I just don't see the market planets aligning for that to ever be torn down or rebuilt as commercial.
Okay. So that's the proposed amendments. I don't know if you have any other additional questions or comments.
Well, those are the amendments that are new that the Planning Commission didn't see because they've come up since then. We have 21 slides that go through all the other stuff that's in your staff report that the Planning Commission did review at their August meeting. So the question for you now is, do you want us to go through those, or did you, any of you have questions on any of those? Are you comfortable that the Planning Commission reviewed all those items and you're okay with us taking that to a Planning Commission hearing, and then you would see them again at first reading of the ordinance?
So I personally don't need you to go through it. I do have a couple of questions, however. Is anybody?
I also have a couple of questions.
I guess my concern would be, was there any items that the Planning Commission, you know, focused on that were?
Yeah, they were noted in the.
Okay.
In big issues.
The language that they suggested is incorporated into the
okay. Pathway. Then it's fine.
Yep.
I'm okay with it.
You can jump to whichever slides that are relevant to questions you might have.
So I was looking at outdoor dining and sales, page 102 of the code. And what caught my eye was the 270 days for outdoor dining, and then the outdoor sales was 180. I don't know if there's a question. What is the rationale of 180 days? And why wouldn't you allow it during the good weather, more like the 270? Is there any reason why we should have a diminished outdoor sales as opposed to outdoor dining?
I don't think the 180 is a magic number. I think it's just something that we thought was reasonable at the time.
Okay.
That the UDC was created.
We could certainly make them both 270.
I think I'd rather allow more than less. Yeah.
Given global warming. Oh,
well.
Right.
I can make it use all those 270s.
Okay. Got that one. Yeah, I guess the other questions I had were related to the new ones, and we got them covered. I don't have any more questions. Go ahead, Forrest.
Just a couple. So what was the reasoning on the tree size?
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Is it just because that's where the nursery market is right now, or?
I mean,
why go down?
Well, let me just turn there. Well, it's not for all trees. It's just for understory, small maturing, or ornamental trees. The overstory would still be 2 inches minimum, but if this is to...
Okay, that makes an answer.
Yeah, I think in what you provided for us, we didn't have the context of what the change was. So we were really kind of grasping for it.
Yeah, because I was really surprised that I was like, well, I mean, if you're planting like a big tree, it's always better to, but if it's ornamental, small, like that makes
sense. That was the thinking.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, what we... Obviously, repurpose the slideshow. We'll change depending on the slide. I'll clarify that it's just for the small types of trees, not the large. So that might help.
Yeah.
And then, could you talk a little bit more on the landscaping requirements? I was maybe missing a little bit of the context there too.
Let's see here. Which page is that?
134. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as far as the amount of landscaping, that is just kind of the existing language was hard to for our developer to figure out what area we were considering in the growth area of the parking lot. So we tried to define it more what that meant. Does that make sense, or does that answer
your question? So it's just kind of clarity is what you're trying to make.
Right, we're just trying to clarify what is considered the area of the parking lot that's calculated for the tree or for landscaping. So we have a minimum requirement of 10% of the parking area has to be landscaped. So we're defining that what that area is, because we found that developers were kind of scratching their head and they didn't understand what that area is. So from the existing language.
Sounds good.
Did you have a question about the other thing too with the tree size there?
No, I just figured it looked like you just referred back to where you define it, which makes sense. And then the other thing we talked about.
All right, very good. Anything else? Nothing from council, nothing from staff.
Go Vikings. Oh, wait. Yeah, that's about it. So I did want to have a quick conversation with you guys. Today I had a CMC meeting. I voted no on the alignment, and I want you guys to understand why. It was about trust in them bringing and cutting our service on 81 in inner city. I'd talked to them early on, like 2.5, 3 years ago, about trust and how that needed to be built based after what had happened with the pedestrian bridge and whatnot. And I had been bringing up the stuff about safety, about it was primarily safety, but I think I'm losing my place. Excuse me. It's getting late. But I wanted you to be aware it did pass overwhelmingly. So I wasn't too concerned about it passing or not passing. But the fact that they cut service was the point that I was making during the meeting. And that was more of an explanation point. It wasn't about undermining anything because it's...
What do you mean they cut service? Because there's only one bus route that...
They cut service on 81. And then there was service that is on the southern side. We basically don't have service on weekend in some places where we used to. In other places, it's a 2-hour wait. So I brought that to their attention a number of times. And basically my comment was, you know, it's disingenuous to be promoting a light rail process while cutting other transit services. So that's one of the things that I haven't gotten a decent response from. And I'm really hoping this will highlight that. So that was my reasoning. And before it hits the news or anything, I wanted you guys to understand where I was coming from.
So I used to ride that that 14 bus that went on 81.
Yeah.
And typically that line, you know, because when it ran, it maybe had like maybe 2 or 3 people on it. Uh-huh. And then at that time, the frontage roads were on both sides. So it basically go up one side of the frontage road, down the other side of the frontage road, and then get back on the 81 and go down and then go to Hubbard. And so with the redesign of County Road 81 and the fact that there was limited use by that bus, that's why that service was discontinued.
Well, that particular one.
The 14. Yeah.
But the one that goes to the park and ride on 63, there's nothing going through there anymore.
Right. And now again, so that, the only time I've ever used that particular bus service is during the fair. So you would park there and it would be a bus that would take you to the fairgrounds. And I think there was a bus at one time that got off of 94, went there, you know, to that particular parking ramp. And I'm not sure of the number of people it picked up at that time or whatever. And then we get back on the 94 or 694 and then go down 94 to go downtown. So, I mean, you could probably have MTC tell you the so-called number of people that were using it. And a lot of times they do studies and they you know, give, you know, multiple opportunities for ridership to present itself for them to keep that particular
right. I mean, we can talk about the inner numbers of a particular line and whatnot, but what's not happening is there's not transit being developed in Crystal. It's actually being undone, and you cannot support a light rail system as you're cutting the habit of riding.
Right,
and that's what I'm trying to get reversed.
But the existing light rail system, even with the blue line and the green line,
sure.
Once those light rail systems went in, the MTC connected to the light rail system, and like at every stop, I mean, if you ride the light rail system at every stop, it tells you which bus line, which services for ridership is available at each transit station, who you can connect to. And so make sure that it's, you know, very clear audible wise, if you're planning on getting on the on the 5, you know, going, you know, east, west in Minneapolis or something like that, it'll tell you which stop you have to get off in terms of getting to that particular. So it's kind of like, you know, what do you need first? I mean, do you need the horse or do you need the cart? I mean, and so it's like, it's part of the process of putting light rail in.
I understand that's going to be coming at some level, but at what level is it?
And then my last point is, I think I've asked you this very point before, is that anytime you're going to be in a voting situation that you confer with council before you go ahead, because I think you should carry our message. You know, I know you have, you know, your own personal beliefs in terms of when it comes to light rail, in terms of what
I think needs to be done. Than your message.
But I think it's important that we as a council decide what that message is going to be and how you should vote. And I mean, I think that that's more important.
Okay. So that should be true in the fire board as well.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Well, I do believe that I'm covering more of what the citizens want, and that's more service in Crystal.
We're talking about the council.
Well, you know what you're talking about. I heard you loud and clear.
Yeah, great.
I heard you loud and clear.
We're done.
Are we now?
Yeah.
So anything else? Any other questions?
Well, I just say that last night the EQC met with the Metro Transit planners and Sophia, the community the community liaison, and we had a very informed discussion about transit in Crystal, which was great, and their plans for the future. And kind of a big takeaway from that was the planners at Metro Transit and kind of at every metro system across the country is recognizing that transit patterns now are very different than they were in 2019. And so they are making a conscious decision not to bring things back to where it was in 2019, but kind of really look at it from a whole new lens, from the new patterns. And they're doing that through, maybe John, you know, next strategy or transit next, or it's something snazzy sounding, but essentially it's going to be their short-term strategic plan that's going to guide them in this next phase of transit development, now that they've addressed the fiscal cliff, moving on to that. And that was that big survey. I think John did a great job promoting that to residents. And Sophia said they got a lot of really good response. And I think it's changing some of how they've been thinking about transit. I mean, I know that back when I was going to school, it was very like, we're building routes where we want development to be, not where development is. And I think that through the survey, through some of their initial kind of group work and engagement, they've heard overwhelmingly the opposite. And so it sounds like they're really going to be looking at meeting transit where it is now. And that's going to be, they're looking to kind of by March, April of next year, having that plan in a pretty good place where there'll be some comment abilities for us as a city to comment on that. And so I think that that's really exciting that they're not just saying, pandemic's waning down. It's now let's just go back to what we had in 2019, because they recognize that it's not that anymore. And so that's where they're headed right now. And I thought I was really happy to hear that they're not just going back to the way it was.
It's good to know. Thanks for sharing that. All right. I think we're adjourned.